surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel. Hi, everyone. This is Red Hoffman. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Today, I'm so excited to be talking to Dr. Rebecca Osluckson. Rebecca is an anesthesiologist who is also board certified in both critical care medicine and hospice and palliative medicine. She is an associate professor at Stanford University, as well as an adjunct professor at both the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. She serves as the Division Chief of Adult Critical Care Medicine within the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative, and Pain Medicine at Stanford, and is also on the faculty at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Rebecca is a well-known researcher and prolific author, and has devoted her career to improving the delivery of advanced care planning and palliative care, particularly to perioperative and critically ill populations. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here today. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Thank you, Red. It's just a privilege to be asked.
So, Rebecca, as we're getting started, can you share a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you trained, and why you chose a career as an anesthesiologist?
Sure. So I grew up in northern Illinois, just kind of where urban becomes rural. So if you went in one direction, the buildings would keep getting taller until you got to Chicago, about an hour and a half away. And the other direction, it was just fields. So it was kind of an interesting place because it was very small town, not diverse at all. And my grandparents were in the same town as my parents, were in the same town as us. And my parents were the first of their generation to go to college. My father still is a General Motors car dealer. My mom used to teach kindergarten. So, and that's the environment I grew up in. And then I was really blessed and lucky to figure out early in my life that I loved research. And I just loved science. I loved research. And I feel so lucky to have had kind of that internal compass because I figured that out and then went to a public boarding school for math and science where, oh my gosh, people actually left the state for their jobs. You know, like, my gosh, you know, universities, I mean, Ivy Leagues, those places seemed like fairy tales to me growing up. They weren't even in my life. If you were really good, you went to the University of Illinois, which we are so blessed. It's an amazing state school. But, you know, that was it. Math and science public boarding school just changed my goalposts. I knew I wanted to go into research. And then I went to WashU in St. Louis for undergrad, where I started to do research on HIV. And it's funny because I was interested, I always wanted to be a PhD researcher. I was interested in molecular phylogenetics and how different species evolve. And I happened to just work in HIV because, oh gosh, it was a good data set. And it was, this is now the early 1990s, it was looking at how patients who are HIV positive, but not yet having AIDS, how the virus evolved within them. And it was astounding because you would have these deep root problems. We'd make these gene trees. And within like 1 year in one person, you would have the same problems in evolution that we have when we're trying to figure out like, how did humans like diverge from apes and such?
Wow.
There's so much evolution that just happens in one person. And so that was fascinating to me. And so I thought, well, gosh, you know, but I don't want to be somebody who just like gets other people's data. I want to get my own data. And I was like, well, if I have to get my own data and I want to work in HIV, I'm going to have to be a doctor. Oh, okay. So I was like, okay, I'll be an MD, PhD. So it was just, it was an afterthought to me. It was a means to an end. I want to be able to get my own data.
Fascinating.
And, And then what's interesting too, and now I go back and I look, and I always was destined to be a palliative care person. It's just, it's in my warp, it's in my weft. Because when I was interested in HIV, I was always really interested in the lived experience. Like, what was it like to have HIV? And it's funny because it's one of the things now that I appreciate, that's just a narrow window of us who really came of age in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when HIV was a terminal illness. And it was a huge cultural phenomenon, particularly if you were in certain communities. And I mean, I have these experiences of my friends in college, and what was it like to go to a public health center where you would be given a number because you would be getting an HIV test, and it was privileged information. What was it like to sit there and think, am I positive? Am I not? You know, and one of my good friends in college, his partner was positive and he wasn't. So he had to get tested every month. You know, I was with one of my good friends in college when he seroconverted. We didn't know it at the time, but he was, and went through his first appointments with, at the time, antiretrovirals were just coming out, just coming out. And we were talking in the waiting room going, gosh, do you go on them early and just be on them from the start? Or do you wait and use them later? You know, because we really didn't know.
Yeah.
And so I was always really interested in the, how people experience their disease and they experience serious illness. And it's funny because that seeped into my HIV work. And then it started to just be there always when I was in medical school. And it's funny because I had a close a physician who I trusted, who was one of my physicians. And I remember asking her, if you were doing this all over again, what would you do? She's like, oh, I think I'd be an anesthesiologist. And I didn't even know what that was. I was like, oh, wow. I didn't have any idea. And to this day, my parents still can't pronounce it. They call it anesthesia. And I keep saying, seize the day. It's a seziologist. Seize the day. You know, so I've been an anesthesiologist for almost 20 years. And my father still can't say the word. but it's very endearing. But yeah, she said she'd be an anesthesiologist. And I was like, what's that? And so when I did my surgery rotation, as a third year, which yet again, I liked my surgery rotation and I liked the environment, but I also was like, nope, don't want to be a surgeon. Like, it just didn't feel right. But I really liked the OR. And then I just realized that I liked anesthesiologists. Like, it just seemed like a nice community. And I love working with my hands. I love also being able to kind of focus all my attention on one person at a time. That's very emotionally satisfying for me. Mm-hmm. So at that point I thought, okay, well, 90% chance pediatrician, 10% chance anesthesiologist. And then I did my peds rotation 2 weeks in. It was like, nope, not this.
100% anesthesiology.
Yep. And so then it was anesthesiology. And I've just been so blessed because it's a wonderful field. And I mean, I love working in the perioperative space. And it's just a really nice fit. And as a researcher, it's a really nice fit because in some ways you're on or you're off. I don't build up a patient population. I'm not like a pain doc where I have a group of patients who are my patients who I follow as an outpatient. So it's really great as a researcher because I can go in, do a week of work in the ICU, and then come out and do my research work, and things don't linger between each other. And I was very compelled by my long stay ICU patients. The 10% of our patients that take up 40% of our resources, the ones who you just can't get out of the ICU, we would call them the chronically critically ill. To me, those were just the loudest voices in the room. When I go into the ICU, they were the people whose pain and suffering just seemed to be there. My grandmother understands that when you're sick, you want to have a conversation about what you want, what you don't want. Why is this so hard for us to do? And it's funny because when I was going on to fellowship, I was still interested in research. And I said, you know, I think I want to do communication research. And I'd get a lot of folks almost like an arranged marriage saying, gosh, well, you communication's important, but we have a great genetics department here. You should be a geneticist. And I was interviewing at Johns Hopkins. I was interviewing with the person who later became my primary mentor for over 10 years, Peter Pronovost. And when he said, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, you know, patients and families and communication and long stay ICU patients. Instead of saying, you know, I've got a friend who's a geneticist, he said, oh, that's really important. That's incredibly important. There's a whole career in that. You know, I'm really glad you're interested in that. And I just really went that direction and didn't change. So I finished fellowship, immediately rolled into a PhD program because also Peter had said, you know, I can't mentor you in everything. You're going to need more skills to be able to be a successful researcher in this. And I said, well, I always wanted to do a PhD program. So so sign me up. I'm there. And then I really learned about palliative care. It wasn't until about a year later. It was actually, I'm so incredibly grateful to him. It was Jeff Dunn. Who you know well, the founder of the Surgical Palliative Care Task Force, kind of the father, grandfather of palliative care and surgery. And he was at my institution at the time as a visiting speaker. And he said, what are you interested in? I said, oh, you know, communication, long-stay ICU patients. I think this is what I'm going to do my PhD on. And he said, oh, you're interested in palliative care. And I was like, oh, no, Jeff, no. I mean more than end-of-life care. And he just had this. Palliative care is more than end-of-life care. And he was right. And I mean, I had never met a palliative care doctor. My institution at the time didn't have a palliative care team for anybody on the surgical surface. And all I ever cared for was surgical patients. So, I mean, there wasn't anybody who we could consult in palliative care. It was just an alien concept to me. And when Jeff mentioned that, I went and looked into it. And it was this light bulb. It was like, oh, my gosh, there's this community who care about the things I care about and are asking the same questions I'm asking. And it was just finally, you know, round peg, round hole. And I've not looked back since then. And I just feel so incredibly blessed to have that amazing community and have that context in which my research work fits.
Rebecca, I have to say, I don't know that we've ever met in person, but listening to you is like listening to myself. Like the amount of times you have used the word blessed, that's like my word. I loved it. And I loved your stories. I grew up probably around the same time as you when we didn't know much about HIV/AIDS and we were just watching the work of ACT UP and all of these organizations and talking about that lived experience is so important. So it's really interesting to hear your journey. And I also find it really cool that a surgeon turned you on to palliative care.
I will be grateful to Jeff. And I mean, we still keep in touch very much. And I value him as a colleague. I value him as a friend. I value him as a role model.
Lovely.
He's even helped me with my research work. He's been on our stakeholder panels and such. So he's just wonderful. I couldn't say enough wonderful things about Jeff.
So as you were working to establish yourself in this field and the intersection between anesthesiology and palliative care, did you have any mentors in the field of anesthesiology?
I think the short answer really is no. But I've been really lucky to have mentors in anesthesia who could see where I wanted to go. So one of the key things is my main mentor for the first decade of my career was Peter Pronovost. And he himself is not a palliative care person, but he's collaborated with palliative care people. And he connected me with two of the individuals who've absolutely been the most key mentors throughout my career since then. And one is Judy Nelson, who was at Mount Sinai at the time. She's at Memorial Sloan Kettering now. And she's a pulmonary critical care medicine physician and palliative care physician who started improving palliative care in the ICU. And so Peter connected me with her. And then he also connected me with Randy Curtis at University of Washington, a pulmonary critical care medicine doctor, ICU doctor, as well as a prolific palliative care researcher. And so how could I have not gone into palliative care when those two were the people who were most influential in my career? And so I started collaborating with both of them in different ways. I mean, I still am connected with both of them very much. Randy is probably one of the most influential people in my whole career. And I'm so grateful to him for that because he inspires me so with all that he's done as a researcher. And if I can do just a little bit of that as a researcher, I will have done an amazing job. You know, so I think those two people. And as far as anesthesia, I feel like I found other compadres on the road. So we're behind the American College of Surgeons. I don't say that loudly, but, you know.
You just did.
No, I did. But I mean, the American College of Surgeons had the Surgical Palliative Care Task Force in the early noughts, you know, late 1990s, thanks to Jeff Dunn, thanks to Ann Mosenthal, thanks to amazing people. Anesthesiology, like, you know, I was part working with Sarah Jebauer, who was at the University of New Mexico at the time, to found the, we were initially a subcommittee within the Committee on Pain at ASA, which was in like 2013. So we were like 13 years behind plus to have really a community within the anesthesia community for folks that are thinking about palliative care. And we became a full committee about 3 years ago. Sarah handed over the chair of the committee to me the year before last, but we're still a small group. We actually surveyed the ASA, Sarah did, in 2015, 2016. And there were about 150, 160 anesthesiologists who were boarded in palliative care. The majority of them were pain docs, interventional pain anesthesiologists, which makes sense. There's a very small subset of critical care anesthesiologists like myself who do palliative care, but a lot of it's been pain. And I mean, we just this month came out 3 days ago in the ASA Monitor, which is our internal publication for anesthesiologists within the ASA. And they have a special section on palliative care and what palliative care can be to anesthesiologists and why they should know about it, why they should be interested in it. because we're still really introducing people to the topic. And there's still quite a few people who, as in all physician communities, all medical communities, who sometimes conflate it with hospice. So we are still having to really help to educate people.
So I read, thank you for sending me all of those essays. And I loved reading your essay. It was so well written, but I also liked the story that you shared. So do you mind sharing a little bit about that patient named David that you talk about in your essay?
Sure. So yet again, when you look, you're like, of course I ended up in palliative care, because when I look back at the patients who mattered to me, they were all palliative care patients, even though I didn't have a word for it at the time. So I was a brand new anesthesia resident. I had started on Monday, and I remember actually on Tuesday, and when you start as an anesthesia resident, typically you're just doing like cystoscopies, knee arthroscopies, you know, really bread and butter cases, day surgery cases, because you're just trying to figure out like, how do I mask a patient? How do I put in an IV? What are these gases that I'm supposed to use? And so I happened to be paired with a thoracic anesthesiologist, Paul Alfier, who's just an amazing anesthesiologist. He practices at Mass General Hospital where I trained. He still does. And he's one of their key thoracic anesthesiologists, and they were short people on Friday. So I started on Monday. They were short people on Friday, and they're like, we're going to move you into a thoracic room.
Wow.
Yeah. And I couldn't do anything yet. I mean, I could put in IVs, maybe, sort of. And I know Paul, and they'd paired us up with a senior anesthesia resident, and he's just trying to find something for me to do that I could do. And he's like, well, go meet the patient. So I go into the pre-op area, and I still remember exactly what that pre-op room looked like. I remember what David looked like. That's not his name. That's actually the name of one of his favorite singers, because I do protect his privacy. You know, and we were just talking, and we just immediately connected. We connected talking about music. He was in his early 20s. There were different artists that we liked. I put in my very first 14-gauge IV on him. First try. Thank you very much. But we just connected. And he was there because he had Gorham's disease, which is essentially where your lymphatic tissue grows almost like a cancer and eats away. It's also called like bone eating disease. And when he'd had it for almost a decade, and when it's bad, it goes into the chest and it's eating away the lungs. So he kept having recurrent pneumothoraces, and he was there to get vats and a talc pleuritesis so that he no longer would have these pneumothoraces, which you look at, it was truly a palliative procedure. Nobody was trying to fix or cure anything here. It was just, you want fewer pneumothoraces. Okay, we're going to do a pleuritesis. So got him into the OR, you know, induced. It became very clear when they tried to get the vats, the scopes in, that they couldn't, and they actually kind of crashed him into an open thoracotomy very quickly, and everything went south. So he ended up with an open thoracotomy. He had had tumor in his back, so we couldn't do any neuraxial anesthesia for him. And we dropped him off in the PACU, went and saw him a few hours later, and he was in horrible pain. I remember Paul put rib blocks in him, and then went back and checked him. And now I would look and say, yeah, he looked toxic. You know, at the time I remember thinking like, he doesn't look very good. You know? Right. And so when I post-opted him, it was because he was in multi-system organ failure in the SICU at that point, intubated, because he had had a horrible anaphylactoid reaction to the talc, is what they thought. And so this was like August 5th. And he was in the SICU until mid-October, you know, intubated, trached, CRRT, everything. I mean, I had not really even rotated in the ICU yet, so I didn't even have an appreciation of all that he had going on. And so there was very little I could do, but I just wanted to be there because I felt like I had this connection with him. I'm getting emotional even talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, and seeing his family go through this, and I got to know his dad and his sister. And so I would just stop in every day. I'd be doing my post-op checks, and I'd just stop in, you know, and check in with his sister, check in with his dad. You know, many times they weren't there, and I just sit there and hold David's hand and kind of talk to him a little bit. And I just wanted him somehow on some plane to know I was there and to know somebody, I'm getting emotional, that cared about him and cared that he was there and that we wanted him to, I don't know if pull through is the right, but just that his life mattered, that he mattered. And so, you know, he came out the other side. I still remember exactly yet again, when he traked, and when the first time I heard his voice again, and he was just like, whatever, Rebecca. And I'm like, it's your voice. I've heard it 2.5 months, you know? And then it was funny because this was also 2004, which anybody in Boston in 2004 knows it's the year the Red Sox finally won the World Series. So the city was total like Red Sox baseball crazy. And of course, David was a Yankees fan.
God.
So like a bunch of the Red Sox had come to visit him in the hospital. And he was like, oh.
And he was not impressed.
Everyone was like, you met David Ortiz. And he was like, whatever. I want to meet Manuel Rivera. But yeah, and so I went and saw him in when he went to Spalding rehab, you know, yet again until he went home. I knew his thoracic surgeon, and his thoracic surgeon let me know a few months later that he had died with his family around him. And so I sent them a condolence card. But how could I have not gone into palliative care? Because that was just those are the patients I care about. Those are the ones where if I'm home with my kids on a Saturday and my brain goes to work, I'm thinking about like, what was their family meeting? How are they doing? How are their parents coping? Or how is their wife coping? And, you know, so it's that passion that's within me. And it's funny because maybe it was your experience. I always thought everybody did a goals of care conversation when every person admitted to the ICU was kind of part of who I was, you know, so I'd be admitting just whatever a regular post-op patient. I'd be like, so, you know, heaven forbid if there's a catastrophe, and none of us are expecting a catastrophe, but heaven forbid if there's a catastrophe, have you ever thought about what you would want? And they'd look at me like, no, I just had surgery. I'm fine. You know, but it was just, to me, it was just kind of how I was wound of like, you know, We need to know who people's goals are, what their goals are and what's their voice. And heaven forbid, if there is a catastrophe, what they would want, what they wouldn't want, what's important to them. And so those questions just compelled me further, especially with the idea that in some ways these are such easy questions. It's not like some gene that we don't know or some crazy biological pathway that we have no way to even study. Like this just involves talking to people. And so why is it so hard? Because it is so hard. Really hard. You know, and so I think a lot of my research career has just been trying to really get at that in different ways, particularly for perioperative patients and pretty much all my projects. And I mean, I have projects now that are like recently partnering with African-American churches to put advanced care planning, like church-based advanced care planning and palliative care discussions out of the hospital and into the church. And, you know, you can look and you can say some of this seems far away, but everything started in the ICU. Every project I've ever worked on has in some way, the seeds are in the intensive care unit. And since I worked exclusively for the first 15 years of my career in surgical ICUs, they're all surgical questions.
In your clinical world, how do you utilize your palliative care trainings? What does your clinical world look like?
So I'm mostly still a researcher, always have been, always hope to be in some sense, although I do some administrative work now. But clinically, I do 60% of my time in the ICU as an intensivist, and then I do 40% of my time as an inpatient palliative care physician. And it's wonderful because the two really play off each other. I'm at Stanford University. I came here about 2.5 years ago. And when I started, we weren't sure what I was going to do in palliative care. Like, was I going to do inpatient? There was some discussion about starting like an outpatient palliative care clinic specifically for surgery patients and their unique issues. They wonderfully gave me a couple of months to say, kind of figure this out and come back to us. And I was doing ICU still at the time. And I came back and said, you know what? I'm an inpatient person. I'm an inpatient palliative care person because when I'm a palliative care doc, I'll often say, hey, when I'm not doing this job, I'm an ICU doc. So let's talk about the ICU. Because many times those are your conversations in the hospital. If you get worse, what do you want? And if you don't have conversations and you get worse, you end up with me in the intensive care unit. So let's think about that. Let's talk about that. And then when I'm an ICU doc, I'll say, you know, when I'm not doing this job, I'm a palliative care doc. So can we talk about that a little bit? So the two just play off each other beautifully and they potentiate each other. And it's wonderful to do them. And it's funny because I'll do a week in the ICU and I'll think like, okay, all right, done, you know, and I'll then go do palliative care and it's a wonderful respite. And I'll do palliative care. And it's funny because I'll hit the end of the week and I'll feel some compassion fatigue coming on and such. And I'll be like, it's time to go back to the ICU, you know, or to go back to research land because the two just play off each other beautifully.
And when you're acting as a critical care attending, what are some of the palliative care skills that you're trying to impart to your trainees?
Well, I mean, first off, I think there's a whole group of us. I mean, I've mentioned Randy Curtis and Judy Nelson, Chris Cox is another at Duke, who went into critical care in some really because of the palliative care. Like I couldn't have said it at the time, but what I love about critical care is the palliative care because it's everywhere. It's everywhere in the intensive care unit. I mean, palliative care is for patients with serious illness. And by definition, everybody in the ICU has serious illness because otherwise they wouldn't be there. So it's all around you. And once you start to see it, you can't go back. I always say it's like seeing in Technicolor. you can't go back to black and white. You can't go back to two-dimensional. Once you see the palliative care in the ICU, you're in Technicolor, you're in 3D, you're in 4D, and you never would even choose to go back because it's such a richer way to practice. It just gives so much more depth and meaning to what you do. When I'm, and I've always practiced in academic settings, so I always have trainees around, and I'll laugh and I'll say, you know what, I love critical care. I said, you want to talk about acid-base? I love acid-base. You know, we can talk about antibiotics. I said, but I'm going to talk a lot about palliative care this week. I've been told that if I don't teach it, you typically don't hear it. So I'm going to teach a lot about it. And if I teach too much, you tell me. But I've gotten feedback through the years and through the written surveys that you want to know more about palliative care. So I really just try to embrace it, but to do it in an open way. I teach a lot about spirituality and creating a space for spirituality, because that's something that is so incredibly important to ICU patients. I mean, when you look, there was a wonderful review on the topic, I think it was in Journal of Critical Care, that came out 3 years ago. And it's like combining studies, 64% to 94% of family members of critically ill patients note spirituality and religion to be important, to very important to them. And yet we almost never talk about it. We almost never say it. And so I always say, you know, it's not about my spirituality or religion, which I actually consider to be very, very personal. It's not about your spirituality or religion. It's about if you're comfortable creating a space for that, so that if it's important for your patients and family members, they can express it and they can feel supported in it, because it can be a very big part of how they make meaning out of their illness and how they cope. So I'll teach about spirituality. I teach a lot about communication skills. I teach a lot about how information is both cognitive as well or emotive, and that how in medicine we live in the cognitive. I mean, we love the cognitive. We go to our happy pathophysiologic place whenever we're uncomfortable, but that's not where many patients and families are. They're often in the emotive. So, you know, when you say, I'm so sorry, I wish things were different, you know, your cancer has come back, and they go, oh my gosh, what do you mean? If you go to the cognitive, you go, okay, here's the CT scan, and look, this is the liver, look at this little white spot, and you know, that's cognitive. But if instead they go, what do you mean? And you go, oh my gosh, I can't imagine how sad you must be. I can't imagine how frustrated you must be. You did everything right. You turned your life upside down. You did all these chemo treatments. You had surgery, and this still happens. You know, so trying to get folks to really understand those two different spheres and to be comfortable and to have the skills to go to the emotive, because that's where the money is. That's where families are. You know, every once in a while you have a family who wants to go cognitive, but so many times it is emotive. And so how do you really teach that comfort level with that and get people to see it?
And not only is that where the money is for the patients and the families, but that's where the money is for us, right? Mm-hmm. Like that for me is what brings meaning to my world and makes all those hours worth it, because you have these rich connects with patients.
Oh my gosh, it is. And I mean, I'm sure as you have, you get people who go, gosh, you're a palliative care doc. Wait, how many family meetings did you have? And you're like, yeah, I had like 5 today, 6 or something. And they'll go, how did you do that? You must've been there till midnight, or you must go home and want to, like, you know, I don't know, listen to Adele and watch or something and think how horrible life is, you know? But I say, well, first off, when you know how to go and work in the emotive and be comfortable with that, so many family meetings that would take a long time actually are rather short, because that's where the money is. So, you know, I always laugh and say, if you stay long enough in the cognitive, you get emotive, because if you just talk and explain things long enough in that spinning circle, you're actually building trust, because people are going, well, at least she cares enough to stay and talk to me 45 minutes about, you know, the difference between CRRT and IHD, or, you know, the pathophysiology of AFib. So you kind of can get emotive if you stay in the cognitive long enough. But if you just go right to the emotive, you know, many of these conversations, they don't last 5 minutes, but they don't last 2 hours. So you can do them reasonably. And I, like you, I mean, I go home, I hug my kids, I, you know, kiss my spouse, and I feel like I've made the world a better place. And it's such a privilege, it's just an incredible privilege to be allowed into that kind of sacred space with people as they are contemplating these huge issues and trying to make meaning out of their life and out of what's happened in their life. And I mean, that for me is the reason to get up in the morning.
So we're going to shift a little to the cognitive, because sure, I do want to talk about all of your amazing research.
Thank you.
But I have to tell you, it's a real joy to listen to you, because reading your bio sketch, it's just really interesting, because that kind of captures this one side of you. But I always tell Jeff Dunn this. I say, after interviewing all these people for this podcast, like, we all have the same DNA and we have this very emotional, spiritual DNA. And we may have all these intellectual pursuits on top of it, but I think many of us are very heart-centered to begin with, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, let's talk a little bit about your research.
Oh, sure.
So can you talk a little bit about the work you've done to improve the delivery of palliative care to ICU patients and their families? I'm actually particularly interested in some real life advice that you may be able to offer listeners who want to utilize these skills at their institution.
Sure. Well, I think first off, if I go back too far, you tell me, but I think it's really rooted in a story, and it gets back to yet again in the ICU, like, why are these conversations so hard to have? And so I started my career doing studies into like how adequate is our communication regarding prognosis. You know, when I did focus groups, I did cross-sectional surveys, I did a big systematic review, and really was the idea of like, we're going to build an intervention. This was going to be the crux of my PhD thesis. You know, we're going to build an intervention in the ICU to help us better communicate about prognosis and about goals. I worked exclusively in a surgical ICU, so of course it was going to be, you know, surgical patients and such. And so it's funny because there, this is now kind of 2008, 2009, and there were the Lilly trials that had come out of the Brigham, which just sounded like, oh my gosh, this is what we need to do. Because they had like these 4-point conversations. You did them after 72 hours when the patient was in the ICU, and it was kind of one of your goals. With the Lilly trials, they showed it as single site, and it decreased disagreements between the clinicians and the family members. It decreased disagreements between the different clinicians, so the different clinician teams, and then it also decreased ICU length of stay. I was like, man, win, win, win. Like, we are going to do this. This is so a problem. And I tried to roll it out in our surgical ICU, and it completely didn't work. I mean, 2 years of my life, so much work, so much time, so many people. And I mean, wheels coming off the bus, what was, at which you look back, you're like, but of course, what was built in a closed medical ICU with very few providers and what worked there did not work in a semi-open ICU with 30 some surgeons and, you know, 15 different ICU providers. And, you know, surgical patients are really different. They're different than medical patients in the ICU. And so what was built for medical patients isn't going to work for surgical patients. And so I went back to a funder, the Foundation for Anesthesia Education and Research, and put in a mentored research training grant saying, I actually want to do a large qualitative study about surgical ICUs and try to figure out why they're different. You know, so we interviewed surgeons, we interviewed patients. Not many could talk to us because they were too sick, but we interviewed their family members. We interviewed patients and family members in the ICU. And then 6 months later and 12 months later, we interviewed surgical ICU nurses. We interviewed intensivists. And we just tried to do essentially 360s around the patients to figure out what is their experience, what is their family's experience, and whether it's being understood by their teams. And one of the key things that has just driven my career ever since as a researcher is we heard from family members again and again and again. They said, you know, I expected everything, but not this. They told me all the list of all the things that could happen after surgery, but this wasn't on the list. And it really drove down to this idea that when patients and families were getting ready for major surgery, they really thought there were two outcomes. Things were going to go well. And yeah, they might be in the ICU a while. They might have some time on the floor, some time in rehab, but they'd slowly get better. And you know, that's what they planned. Or if it was bad, they were going to die on the operating room table. And I think we all know who work in perioperative spaces. Unless you're talking like a ruptured AAA or a trauma patient, almost nobody dies on the operating room table. You know, if they die, it's in the days to weeks to months afterwards when they just can't get better. They just have problem after problem and they can't get out of the ICU. And family members and patients, they didn't appreciate that. So they would think like, oh my gosh, I made it through surgery. My wife made it through surgery. Yay, we're in bucket one. She's going to get better. We're on the good side, you know? And so they didn't have any appreciation for that there's really bucket three and that's what you got to worry about. You know, and so for us, we said that this really is an opportunity because this is a gap. This is a gap in advanced care planning. We need to have better conversations before they hit the ICU to, heaven forbid, in case these issues happen, in case these situations come up, to better enable the family members to be able to make decisions for their loved ones. And if you're talking a surgical population, that means if you're going to go before the ICU, that means you're going to go into the preoperative period. And so we started to do studies in preoperative surgery clinics. And I've been so lucky to have amazing surgeons who have seen this vision with me and who've wanted to go on this journey. And I got to say, when we started on this journey, it was like 2011, 2012. And so Gretchen Schwarzi's surgical buy-in stuff had just come out.
And it, oh, wow. Perfect timing.
It was great timing, but it was also horrible timing because they're like, don't do advanced care planning conversations because then the surgeons aren't going to offer surgery. And like, you're not working in the best interest of patients. But the thing was, is I had all this qualitative data and I had all of these patient voices saying, I just didn't understand what was going. And so when folk would say, how can you do this? That like, you're crazy. You're going to do advanced care planning and surgery, you know? And I'd say, but this is the right thing to do. And a lot of my major work has been funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which is really just about bringing in all the different stakeholder voices and amplifying them and trying to figure out your way forward with really complex problems. You know, and this is a complex problem. You know, when I get frustrated and like, you know, I remind myself, this is a really hard problem. It's worth my life's work. It's a hard problem. So you bring everybody together in a room, and especially when you bring data, that's one of the things I love about working in surgical spaces for research. As a community, this is a community that really respects data. It may be data they don't like or they don't agree with, but if you bring data to the party, people will dance and they will work and they will move forward. So I've really, a big part of my career has been always bringing data in that I've gotten from all these different stakeholders and saying, how do we move forward? How do we build this intervention? How do we do things better than what we're doing? And it's wonderful because it's always more than I could ever do myself. And I always end up in a place I never would have thought because it's not just my thoughts. It's the surgeon's thoughts. It's the patient's and family member's thoughts. It's the oncologist's thoughts. It's the nurse's thoughts. And you put it all together and you end up somewhere really interesting and different than if it was just you. And I think it's so much more practical in that sense because it's taking account into all these different stakeholder views. So when you're saying kind of practical things for people moving forward, first off, I get asked this a lot about like ICUs, like how do we do better palliative care in the ICU? And the biggest thing I always say is every community, like every patient is really different and you can have different communities and different ICUs, even in the same hospital. And it's really an idea of what do you do well? What is the culture that you are working in? And then what is evidence-based that will fit that culture well? If you are working in a surgical community or an ICU where people don't practice a lot of primary palliative care, this is a taboo topic. This is something that you don't really talk about. I probably wouldn't roll out what we would call like an integrative or a primary palliative care model where you're expecting those people to suddenly be able to have these conversations and to do this because some of them don't see it as part of their job description. They didn't sign up to do this. They don't feel like they have the skills for it. And I can speak from personal experience because that's essentially what we tried to do in the surgical ICU with my PhD when it really didn't work. You know, in those kinds of environments, you're going to want to think about consultative models. You're going to want to think about how do I have triggers to bring in specialists? And then the specialists will change the culture over time. It's not going to happen in a day. It's going to happen over, you know, months to years. But culture does change. And I think our broader culture around palliative and end-of-life care is changing too, and that's helping. But if you have an ICU where people very much have signed in on this, they're like, oh my gosh, the reason I became an ICU doc is to have these conversations. The reason I became a surgeon is to have these conversations. Then pull evidence-based stuff off that makes those conversations better. So if you're a surgeon, I mean, I think the world of Gretchen Schwarzi and her research work, you know, let's talk about best worst case framing and make sure you're trained and you're able to do that. You know, if you're an ICU doc, here are these different interventions that have worked. But there's good evidence-based stuff out there, but you have to know your environment. You have to know your situation because what works for one will not work in another. So it really just gets down to the whole, like, politics is local. All of this is local. Where are you? What are you wanting to do? And then what are the different evidence-based things you can pull off the shelf?
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about the Periop PC trial?
Oh, sure. Yet again, this guy, it's all the story. So we need to do better advanced care planning before surgery. And the first step we did is we said, okay, we're going to do video-based advanced care planning. We're going to, and this was funded by PCORI, we're going to develop a video very specifically for surgical patients that encourages them before major surgeries to have a conversation about, you know, who you are, what's important to you, what's not. And we're going to show these videos before surgery. And we had like a control video that just said, you know, this is a great place to have surgery. Yay. Osler was here, you know, like, so, and then our video, which was showed like what things looked like, but also said, you know, have conversations. And people, yet again, they thought we were crazy. Like, what? You're going to show advanced care planning videos before major surgery? Like, are you going to have surgeons going to let you do this and such? And in some ways I can ask these questions because I'm outside of surgery. I feel like there's certain things I can do as an anesthesiologist just because I see the world differently that wouldn't necessarily come if I was a surgeon, because I come from a different community. I have a little bit of a different culture. And we did. And I have wonderful, amazing surgeons who went on this journey with us, and they let us show these videos as well as audio record them having consent conversations, saying, you know, do the videos change these consent conversations? Because our hypothesis was patient and family are going to watch these videos and they're going to think about what they want. And then they're going to, at the end of the video, it says, talk to your surgeon about what you want and what your goals are. And we're like, they're going to come in, they're going to be like, hey, this is what I want, this is what I not want. So we already recorded those conversations. And we finished the trial and people liked our video. They found it more helpful than the other one. Nobody's head popped off, which I said is important to show, because when you're bringing palliative care into surgical settings, you need to say this wasn't harmful, because there's still a lot of people who are scared about it or fearful or think that you're going to scare patients away. And so you need to show like, hey, this was well tolerated. Nobody's head popped off. People actually liked it. They valued it, which is, I think, in and of itself, a really important message, especially when you're thinking about first steps into surgical communities. But it also didn't change the conversation. Mm-hmm. So when we audio recorded these conversations, whether the patients saw our video or the other video, it didn't really change the surgeon's conversation. And we went back and talked with surgeons and others and had stakeholder summits with patients and family members. And surgeons said, you know, I kind of got my spiel. I kind of just, whatever, anybody comes in, if I'm prepping for this surgery and I'm consenting them, I kind of got my phrases and I do it. And, you know, kind of whatever people ask, I go into my spiel. And so it's really hard to change that. We thought, well, maybe the surgeons, you know, I'm a big believer there's got to be lots of different models. There's not going to be one thing. We need to have many, many, many different approaches for these complex issues. So, you know, I get some folks that are like, oh, are you competing with Gretchen Schwarzy or whatever? And I'm like, oh my gosh, no. Like, we need everything.
Right.
We need all these different approaches, and we need many different ways to approach these problems. We're like so on the same bus going in the same direction. We just sometimes have different ways of doing it. You know, so maybe it shouldn't be the surgeons having these conversations. And we actually, there was some data that came out at the time too, where they asked patients, cancer patients, who do you want to have advanced care planning conversations with? And half said, oh yeah, my oncologist. And the other half said, anybody but my oncologist. So that they wanted to separate that. And we thought, well, maybe patients want to separate some of these conversations from their surgeon, and we maybe give them that space too. And so that came up to Perioperative PC. We said, well, if they're not going to have these conversations with the surgeons, who should it be? We said, well, how about palliative care docs and nurses? How about a palliative care clinician? And what might that look like? And people kind of embraced that. And we had multiple barriers, but we had to kind of address. But this idea of, like, rather than surgeon alone management, what would surgeon palliative care team co-management look like in the perioperative period? You know, where the two are really working together. And there's somebody who can have these conversations if the patient doesn't want to have it with the surgeon. And there's somebody who can support the surgeon in these conversations if that's where you end up going. So it took us, we started in 2014 trying to get this funded, and we eventually got it funded in 2017. And we are the first ever multi-site RCT integrating palliative care specialists into the perioperative period.
Wow.
Yeah, we've now enrolled. We've got four sites. And we're going to roll out at Ohio State in just 2 months. So we've enrolled now 200, I think this week with my study coordinator, we're at 264 patients on our way to 420.
That's incredible.
The interesting thing too is that, yet again, at the beginning, we had some of the surgeons going, are they going to talk about hospice and such? And we're like, no. Like, this is completely different. This is different palliative care because patients are in a different place. And so we actually worked with Allison Cook. She's a surgeon who trained at Methodist and then came to Stanford to do surgical critical care fellowship and then stayed on to do palliative care fellowship. And so she collaborated closely with me on this. And we actually developed these one pagers for our palliative care clinicians that said, like, what's a Whipple? What's a distal pancreatectomy, splenectomy? What is pancreatic adenocarcinoma? What is pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors? And we had it vetted by our surgeon colleagues. And we said, anything you talk about on this sheet is fair game. Everybody's agreed on this. Everybody has signed off on it. Nobody's going to get angry if you talk about it. And we even had some prognosis stuff. And we just went hardcore to the literature and just said, what's the literature? And, you know, and really it was to create this safe space for everybody. I don't think any of our palliative care docs like walked in with that sheet in their hand going, you have a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. This says, like, you know, but it was creating that trust between the surgeons and the palliative care docs and vice versa, that nobody's going to talk about things that are inappropriate. Everybody agrees these are the things to discuss, and then to just educate. So, you know, I think palliative care clinicians, they see like, oh, patient with, you know, pancreatic adenocarcinoma, oh, yikes, like less than 6 months left, and we need to talk about hospice and such. But that's not where these patients are. Like, actually, ironically, these patients, you're going to meet them, and they're going to say they're lucky. And you're going to be like, what? They're lucky because they are the one third of patients who were diagnosed with pancreatic adenocarcinoma where it was early enough that they are still being offered a curative intent surgery. They're being offered a Whipple. So they actually are going to feel lucky, and they're not in that space yet. So, you know, meet them where they are, and this is where they are. And then what we've found is that the palliative care docs really are just kind of following along. They're not having a lot of these big discussions early on, but when things turn south, they've already kind of built this framework. And so, I mean, I'm blinded still. We're in the middle of the trial, but we have anecdotal where, say, the patient's cancer comes back and they're calling our study coordinator, the spouses, and saying, you know, they just had the conversation with, you know, Dr. Pulsides, and sounds like the cancer's back. And my husband doesn't want to talk to me about this. He doesn't want to talk to any of us, but he wants to talk to that Dr. Hidari.
Oh, wow.
Because she created that safe space initially to have these conversations. And so I don't know what we're going to find, but that's already some of the anecdotal stuff that we're finding.
Thank you so much for sharing. As we're wrapping up, Rebecca, is there anything else that you want to add?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, it's just been such a pleasure. I care so deeply about these issues, and to find other people like you and your listeners who deeply care about palliative care issues and the unique experience of surgical patients and surgical providers. And, you know, it's not an us versus them. It's not, you know, I feel like everybody is really trying to move with all altruism towards a good outcome. And we all just have different skill sets and different perspectives. And we need to have open conversations with each other to kind of figure things out, as well as to find have better ways to have really open, meaningful conversations with patients and families about their goals and whether what we can offer is actually going to help them achieve those goals.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been such a joy listening to you.
It's been a joy to talk. It's been wonderful to be asked, and I'm super enjoying listening to your podcast. So I just feel really honored and privileged to have been invited as someone to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at @SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.